Now you can imagine this was a big concern to the U.S. oil companies and to the U.S. government. In fact, it was one of the things that was focused during the highly secretive meetings of the Cheney Task Force on Energy. Now you probably remember that. That was the Cheney Task Force on Energy. It was set up right after the Bush administration took office. And it was that task force that met amid so much secrecy. There was almost total secrecy. They wouldn't even admit who they were meeting with or what the subjects were or anything. Now, some of this information has come out partly through court order, and we now know that they met with, you know, the big, powerful oil company executives. And it was sort of assumed at the time that they were talking about, you know, more tax breaks for the industry or deregulation, these kinds of things. And they were certainly talking about that, but it has also come out that the task force was also interested in big geopolitical questions, particularly the issue of getting control of oil reserves in so-called rogue states, such as Iraq. And there's two documents that have been released basically after big court battles that are really quite fascinating, and they really give us a sense of what this high-level group of, you know, Dick Cheney and the big oil companies were up to. One of them is a document which is this was studied by the Cheney Task Force. It's a map of Iraq, but it's not like your typical map of Iraq. There's no towns or cities or rivers or mountains. All there is Iraq's oil reserves. It's like a naked Iraq, and it's all carved up into oil exploration blocks and where the big gushers are and the pipelines. It struck me when I saw it as it kind of reminds you of one of those meat charts, you know, that you see in the supermarket, you know, that sort of direct you to the choicest cuts of meat. You know, there's the sirloin, there's the flank steak, and oh, there's the filet mignon. You know, they sort of show the most desirable of Iraq's oil assets. Now, another one of these documents that I found fascinating was showing all the oil companies around the world, 63 oil companies around the world, and the status of their negotiation with Saddam for exactly which oil field. In other words, this is what the Cheney Task Force was focused on. They were focused on their fear that this beautiful oil reserve, this last remaining oil bonanza on Earth, was about to disappear into the hands of their chief competitors. Another thing they were terribly concerned about was their desire to privatize Iraq's oil. In the 70s, Iraq, along with other countries in the Middle East, had nationalized their oil industry. That had been a negative development as far as the international oil companies were concerned. They managed to survive, as we see anyway, and they've gone on to thrive and prosper. But they never got over the fact that they no longer are owners. They're now kind of reduced to the role of developers. And one of the key things they wanted to do in Iraq was begin the process of reprivatizing Iraq's oil. Now, it's interesting that at the same time that the Bush administration, the Cheney Task Force is meeting with top oil company executives right after it takes office. This is sort of a top priority, great urgency. At the same time, another thing is going on at the very top level within the U.S. administration, and that is that they begin discussing at the cabinet level plans to overthrow Saddam. Now, none of this was discussed publicly at the time, but we now know about this because of number of insider accounts, particularly the one from Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary. We know that, in fact, right from the beginning, months before 9/11, they were talking about overthrowing Saddam. So you have these two key initiatives taken up with great urgency as soon as the Bush administration takes office. One is to focus on how to prevent all these oil companies from around the world, their chief rivals, from getting their hands on all that beautiful Iraqi oil. And the other is to begin the process of actually trying to overthrow Saddam. And it turns out both these two initiatives, both going on in great secrecy, with great urgency as soon as the administration takes power, both of them just happen to be masterminded by the same person, Dick Cheney. And so it's kind of suggestive that maybe there's something of a connection between the two of them. Now the whole idea that, you know, of what's going on, U.S. actions in Iraq, I want to point out that this is, you know, this is not a unique thing. It in fact fits a broader pattern. I mean, the U.S. has been intervening in the Middle East in the interest of getting control of oil for 5 decades. In fact, you know, we hear so much now about, you know, bringing democracy to the Middle East. What we never seem to be reminded of is the fact that, in fact, there already was democracy in the Middle East back in the 1950s in a place called Iran, and it was actually overthrown by the U.S. government, the same government that says it's trying to bring democracy there now. And again, it was about oil. Back in the early 50s in Iran, there was a popularly elected government. The prime minister was Mohammad Mossadegh, a very moderate guy, actually, educated in France and very sympathetic to British institutions, very moderate, but a nationalist. And he, with tremendous popular support, nationalized the British-owned oil industry. It was basically the company that is later known as British Petroleum, or BP. It had the entire concession for the whole of Iran. And so the Iranian government nationalized, a very popular move in the country, but extremely unpopular with the British Petroleum Company and with all the other big international oil companies. So in fact, they organized a worldwide boycott of Iran's nationalized oil, and they pretty much managed to choke it off. They brought Iran's economy to its knees within a couple of years. But even so, Iran and the people of Iran held fast. They were determined not to give up on the oil nationalization. It was very strongly supported. So they were, you know, refusing to give in. So what happened was the British and American governments organized a coup that overthrew this democratically elected government. Mossadegh, the prime minister, ended up under house arrest for the rest of his life. And the Americans, you know, brought back the Shah, the ruling monarch who'd been kind of who'd fled the country, and they brought him back and installed him as the absolute dictator in Iran. Just a brutal dictator, just as bad as anything Saddam later got up to in Iraq. And you know, ruled for 25 years with full American support, crushed all dissent. In fact, what ended up happening was that the only venue where dissent was possible, and it wasn't, I shouldn't say dissent was possible, where even getting together in any form was possible, was the mosques. So the mosque became a kind of center, you know, for a clandestine movement that was both, you know, vigorously, viciously anti-Shah and also anti-U.S. for supporting the Shah. And it, of course, took on a kind of Islamic character. And this was really the beginning of the kind of Islamic fundamentalist rage against the West that we later, of course, saw develop into, you know, such actions as 9/11. But it really did sort of begin with that whole situation in Iran. So there's this long history, really, of Washington intervening for oil. It's not always violent. Sometimes countries simply capitulate. You know, one country that comes to mind, for instance, is Canada. There's a country that's capitulated. I mean, the truth is that the U.S. has long, you know, been very interested in getting control of our energy. In fact, that was a key goal on the part of the U.S. in going after the NAFTA deal. They wanted guaranteed access to our energy, and they got it. They got it. For instance, there's a section in NAFTA which prevents us from cutting back on our exports of energy to the United States. So, for instance, if, let's say, there were to be a shortage of oil, in the world, which is not inconceivable in the more problematic energy future that we're headed for, if there were to be a shortage of oil, let's say, in eastern Canada, and let's say, there was a desire to cut back on our exports to the U.S. and instead sell some of that oil to eastern Canada, we wouldn't be able to do that. That isn't allowed under NAFTA. So in fact, what we've done is completely compromised our own sovereignty over our own resource. In fact, it's such a restriction on our own sovereignty, that section of NAFTA, that Mexico refused to sign it. I'm serious. It's funny, but it's true. Mexico would not sign it. And so Mexico was granted an exemption from that section of NAFTA. But we signed it. And this is kind of surprising to people in other countries. In fact, I came across a reference to it in a big energy publication put out by one of those right-wing think tanks in the U.S. It was describing this whole situation, and it sort of raised the question, well, it was talking about how Canada is such a wonderful source of energy for the U.S., so reliable, and it sort of said, now what would happen if there was an energy shortage in Canada? Could we risk being cut off? And then it happily points out, no, because Canada signed NAFTA. It no longer has the power to cut off those exports. It was somehow striking to read that in an American publication and realize how delighted they were with that situation. And I was talking to Colin Campbell, who's one of the world's leading geologists, and was asking him about it, if he knew about it. He said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, he thought it was amazing. He said, you poor Canadians, you could be left freezing in the dark while they're running hair dryers and SUVs south of your border.